Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. It's The Takeaway for Thursday, November 23rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today, and happy Thanksgiving. And as you're driving to Grandma's house today, or maybe just hovering in your kitchen, hopefully you have good health to be thankful for. And hopefully you're one of the increasing number of Americans who can be thankful for health coverage, too. In the heated debate over healthcare reform, there's a lot of terminology to keep track of.
Let's talk about single-payer.
Refundable tax credits.
The individual mandate.
Block grants.
I have pre-existing conditions.
State high-risk pools.
The skinny bill.
Access for affordable care for everybody.
That last one, Paul Ryan, access. It's at the heart of the healthcare debate, but what does it mean? Who has it, and what does it cost? And for those that don't have access, what are the barriers that keep them from getting it? Nancy Toms is Distinguished Professor of History at Stony Brook University. She's also author of Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Nancy Toms says that that crucial term, access, means a lot more than just not being turned away at a hospital.
What that word really means is having some kind of health insurance, either private, public. The way we structure costs in our healthcare industry today is based on the assumption you have some kind of insurance. So access is code for when they say, do you have insurance, pull out that card in the emergency room, you can do it.
But I've heard lots of people in Washington on Capitol Hill over the years say, it doesn't really mean that at all. I mean, even if you're uninsured, look, nobody goes untreated in this country. If the ambulance needs to come, it comes. And if you need to go to the hospital, you go. So everybody has access. I've heard a lot of people say that.
Well, that is indeed true, because even with all the pressures to be money conscious, the medical profession, the nursing profession, all the way down the line, hospitals feel an obligation to help human beings when they're in crisis. So no, they're not going to turn you away most of the time. But is that the way the system should work? Only in America do you have the assumption that it's okay to have large numbers of people not covered by health insurance. Only in the United States do you have a political civil war going on over access.
So does that mean that access really means being able to stay healthy, to see a doctor or a nurse practitioner, to get health advice, to prevent that first heart attack in the first place, rather than saying, yes, if your heart stops, you can get in an ambulance. Nobody's going to stop you.
There's a critical distinction between access to preventive care and access to treatment when you're having the heart attack. Traditionally, the U.S. healthcare system has focused on treating you after you get sick. Consumers have had to fight for decades to get coverage for preventive care. So we have not been a real prevention-oriented nation in terms of what gets covered under our health insurance packages. And if you do not have any health insurance, getting preventive care is going to be as hard as getting that bypass when you need it.
Well, the American healthcare system is weird. There's really no other way to say it when you look at it next to other systems around the world. Look, we have all this debate about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, meant to ensure lots of people who don't have coverage from their employers. But in fact, I mean, the vast majority of us do get our coverage through work. Our employers help pay the premiums, I think about 180 million of us. We're used to this. But when you look at the rest of the world, it really is a strange system. Where does it come from?
Well, weird is a polite word for it. Really, the word train wreck often comes to my mind. In the Great Depression in the United States. So we have a lot of people covered by the 1950s through their employers, primarily to cover hospital bills and also the doctor bills that go with them. It was seen as a perk to get the best employees to work for you. So you see these, they were called service benefits. You still see that term. That's where the United States started out. It was a perk for high-end professionals like IBM. Companies like that were at the forefront of developing these health insurance packages. And then unions got on seeing that the executives were getting these privileges, they began to collectively bargain to get that kind of coverage. So by the late 1950s, you have the executives, and you have the high-end union workers largely covered. Also public employees, so teachers, folks who, you know, work in the post office and, you know, doing all the kind of public business also start to get covered under these plans.
So we're in this moment now, Nancy, where we see this number get thrown around all the time. It's a fraction. That fraction is 1/6. You hear it all the time. 1/6 of the American economy is healthcare. It's a gigantic number. It's in the trillions. Why is it so important? Why is it so big in this country?
That number gets thrown around a lot because it is out of line with our peer. These are high-income capitalist economies with whom we're competing, who pay much less for their health care. So we hear that number because we are the highest. The other reason that number gets brought out a lot is if you compare it with objective measures of outcome, of quality, we're not getting our money's worth. That is the mantra. We pay more and we get less. We pay more, but the average American actually sees a doctor fewer times during the year than their counterpart, say, in Canada or the UK.
And I hear politicians all the time say America has the best healthcare in the world. But if you look at the numbers, Nancy, that's true in almost no objective measure. We don't live as long as many of our peers. Our infant mortality is worse than many of our peers. Our morbidity indicators are worse than many of our peers. And yet this number, 1/6, we're spending twice what many of our peers spend. And then the question's inevitable. Where's the money going? Where does it go?
Well, one of the big differentiators in the way other countries approach their health care is that there is a recognition that too much profit making is a bad thing. So if you look at why these countries with very high end, and I mean, they are cutting edge in terms of the health care they deliver, but there is a kind of unspoken, well, it's spoken now, agreement that they're going to limit profit making. So if you look at hospitals, they're nonprofit. The government will negotiate to keep the price of prescription drugs down. And in other countries, the government is allowed to do that. So there are all kinds of cultural and political restraints on profit taking in other countries. In this country, basically, if it's for profit, it's considered to be better than nonprofit. I don't agree with that, but that's the assumption. If you really want something good, you have to get this kind of corporate focus, and you need that kind of approach to continue to have innovation. I think increasingly we're seeing a lot of countries that don't have this strong profit incentive still innovate. They still come up with new ideas because they're valuable, because they can still make a decent living. It's this focus in this country on no amount of profit taking is ever enough. And we as American people have an obligation to have our health care monetized in this way for the sake of the economy. And you want to talk about resistance to health care reform. It's coming from all the many parties that are making a profit out of the higher costs that we pay.
How important is technology to this conversation, Nancy Toms? How much of the money that we're talking about, the astronomical sums that make the United States different from its peers overseas, goes to the latest device, the latest CAT scan, the latest drug that's expensive because it has no competition, when there might be alternatives, or maybe that test just isn't needed?
When we break out what it is that makes American healthcare so much more expensive than its European or Canadian counterparts, technology is at the top of the list. We are the most screened and scoped people on the planet. So a lot of the hiking up of costs revolves around having the latest scanning device. Unlike other countries, we don't have a system of trying to decide, well, let's just have one high-end MRI in this location and make everybody go and use it. Again, because we're so often profit-oriented in what we're doing, everyone wants to have one. even hospitals that are not being run for profit are competing for patients in a way that means that they have to take some of their hard-earned budget to invest in the latest technology, because they don't want the hospital group in, you know, the nearby city or county or whatever to get those patients away from them.
So, Nancy Toms, your ideological preferences aside just for a moment. Look, debt and hard numbers have a way of focusing the attention of policymakers and the rest of the country, too. Where is this country headed, not only with the aging of the population, but also with that number, that fraction, 1/6, that we also talked about? I mean, it seems like we are headed for an unavoidable place. I'm just not exactly sure what that place is.
I think you're right that in the next 10 years, we are going to see possibly some major changes. I often think of the U.S. healthcare system as a train, and we keep having train wrecks and it jumps off the track and then we kind of nudge it back on. Ideally, we want to be in a system where everyone is covered and there are cost controls and their quality controls. You're not just obsessed about lowering the cost, because we see on the downside of that. That's where you're throwing people out of the hospital after, you know, major surgery to save money. That's not cost effective in the long run. You want to have some quality. You want to make sure that you're investing your healthcare dollars in procedures and drugs that work and that are a good buy for what you're paying for them. That's what we want to get to, ideally. We're not going to get there by an anarchistic system where everyone goes back to acting like a single individual clutching their private health insurance. It's got to be a system that government plays a role in. And every other capitalist country has kind of arrived at that conclusion. Maybe we will, too.
Nancy Toms is a distinguished professor of history at Stony Brook University. She's author of Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Nancy Toms, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, you know how with your iPhone, sometimes an update can have your device just not working right? Tinkering with computer code can be tricky, even for the experts. Well, what about tinkering with DNA code, where the stakes are a lot higher?
Originally, this was just a great tool for, you know, studying diseases and working with genes in the laboratory. But a number of, you know, investigators figured out that, wow, if we can do this with cells in the laboratory, this would be a way to, you know, do the same thing in patients.
Tinkering with the code of the human operating system, the science behind gene therapy. That's coming up here on The Takeaway. Stay with us. All this hour, we're talking about access to healthcare, but that doesn't always mean access to just doctors and hospitals. Dentistry and medicine are often considered two separate systems, and in most cases, dental care isn't even included under health insurance. Add to that, roughly 50 million Americans live in places where it's difficult to get routine dental care. Even for those that do, dental pricing and insurance is a complicated web of exceptions and state laws that can raise barriers to proper care. So journalist Mary Otto traveled around the country to see the state of America's teeth, and she wrote about it in her new book, Teeth: The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America.
I found many stories in many places across the country, and there were shortage areas, communities that have lacked dentists for years, where people end up resorting to emergency rooms or to waiting in long lines and sleeping in their cars, hoping for free care at these temporary field hospital type clinics that are set up with, you know, charity donated care. I found inner city children who had lacked routine dental care throughout their childhoods. I couldn't stop wondering about the system and the places it was breaking down. And I found roughly a third of Americans face significant barriers just getting the most routine kinds of dental care.
So where is this breaking down? Is it strictly an issue of ability to pay and insurance? It sounds like it's not strictly a rural-urban divide, or is it?
No, it's not. There are many places that the system breaks down. A lot of, as you mentioned, many people don't have the ability to pay out of pocket for dental care. Over 100 million Americans lack any kind of dental benefits. The beneficiaries of Medicaid, which is the program that takes care of poor Americans, over 70 million poor Americans, entitles children to care, but fewer than half of Medicaid children get dental care, and fewer than half of dentists participate in the program. And Medicaid doesn't entitle poor adults to dental care, so many of them. It depends on the state. The program leaves it up to the state whether the state covers dental benefits for adults. And these benefits kind of come and go. They disappear in difficult financial times when people need them the most. And Medicare, which covers over 50 million retired Americans, has never included routine dental benefits. So tens of millions of seniors lack dental benefits. And since many of them are living on fixed incomes, they hesitate to go to the dentist. So people wait until they're suffering and in so much pain, they go to an emergency room. So there are just many ways you can fail to find the dental care you need.
Marietta, would you share with me one story from your reporting of somebody who you interacted with, who you met, and their struggles, how poor dentistry affected their life?
I got started on this journey when I met a boy who turned out to be dying of complications from an abscess tooth, Diamante Driver, and he was a 12-year-old boy. He came home from school one day with a toothache and a headache, and his grandmother took him to a hospital, and they diagnosed him with a dental infection and sinusitis and sent him home with some medicine. And the next day, he got worse. His mother took him to another hospital, and he was diagnosed with meningitis and rushed to the big children's hospital in Washington, where they realized he was in serious danger of death. He had two brain surgeries, care costing $250,000, and he ultimately died. And I wrote about his story for the Washington Post. It's so many stages along the way. Preventive care could have helped him. His mother was actually looking for a dentist to see his younger brother when Diamante got sick, but it was very difficult to find a Medicaid dentist in their community in Maryland, just a few miles from the U.S. Capitol. And the shortage of care, you know, routine care, has such serious consequences for people throughout their lives. It was a story I can never forget.
Marietta, you know, we judge each other instinctively on appearance. It's part of who we are. And we judge ourselves that way, too, when we look in the mirror. There must be an enormous impact on people's dignity and on their feeling of self-worth if they have poor teeth. Can you talk about that?
There really is. There's a terrific stigma around poor oral health. You know, on one hand, we live in a country that's made the Hollywood smile or the American smile kind of a status symbol around the world. People spend thousands of dollars, you know, on elective procedures to get, you know, movie star teeth. But on the other hand, we have a third of us facing barriers getting the most routine basic care. And the people who fail to get that care tend to be kind of maybe fatalistic about keeping their teeth at all. And they're also stigmatized and judged. A survey by the American Dental Association a couple years ago found that one-third of low-income Americans are reluctant to smile. They're ashamed of having poor oral health or missing teeth, and that holds them back socially and economically. It can be harder to find a job, especially in the service economy, which is, you know, a great ladder out of poverty for people because, you know, if you don't smile, you're less likely to get a job in a customer-facing position or, you know, hospitality kind of position. And, of course, poor nutrition as a result. You know, if you don't have your teeth, you have a harder time eating healthy foods. It can complicate the management of diabetes, which is a very serious disease that many people in America struggle with. So yeah, there are many, many complications and consequences to poor oral health.
What's the solution in your estimation, Marietta? Is it more funding through Medicaid or state programs to get more dentists in underserved areas? Is that the answer, since so many of these people are low income?
Of course that would help. A stronger safety net clinic system for dental care would also help. We have a, you know, system of safety net clinics around the country, but not enough of them provide dental care. There have been efforts to bolster the availability of dental care through these clinics. Also, there's some very innovative programs going on with school-based clinics and getting care out to senior centers, nursing homes, and schools, not always directly with the use of dentists, but with the use of dental hygienists and other kinds of dental workers who can get the care out to where the people are, whether they're children or elders who can't get themselves into a dental appointment, to just get this kind of routine screenings and preventive services that are inexpensive and simple and quick to provide, and get the people with more urgent needs, help them navigate their way into a dental office or a clinic somewhere where they can get their more serious needs taken care of.
Mary Otto, thank you for joining me.
Todd, thank you so much for listening.
Mary Otto is author of Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America.
The Takeaway is supported by Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
Thanks for being with us on this Thanksgiving Day special takeaway. We're talking all about access to healthcare in America. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we have a story now about access to cures for diseases that not long ago meant little hope for patients. The Food and Drug Administration has been busy lately approving new high-tech gene therapies. Two drugs approved since August are being marketed in new ways to treat rare cancers. One is called Kymriah, the other one's called Yescarta, and both are what's known as CAR T cell therapies. These two gene therapies marked a turning point for many researchers who've been chasing gene therapies for decades, and for patients hoping for cures where before there just weren't any. Dr. Cynthia Dunbar works in the hematology branch at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. She's also the former president of the American Society for Gene and Cell Therapy, and she's here to help explain just how gene therapy works.
Gene therapy is a pretty complicated and quite a large group of different potential treatments, but it's basically transferring new genetic material, either DNA or RNA, into the cells of a patient's body to try to treat a specific, generally very serious disease. And the ways that we get that new genetic material into the body can vary quite a bit, and how long that treatment might work can also vary quite a bit depending on what approach we use. The most common way to get genes in is actually using viruses, kind of using them as little Trojan horses, taking out most of their own genes and fooling them into carrying genes that we want into a cell to be able to treat the disease, because viruses are very, very good at getting into cells and transferring new genetic material into the cell.
Dr. Dunbar, take a second and just sort of tell the story of this field and how researchers like you got from the point of being able to alter genes in a cell and return them to the body, which they've been able to do for some time, not super efficient and the effects don't always stay, to being at the point now where they can use viruses specially programmed to insert good DNA into cells and really maybe be able to cure diseases that never had a cure before.
This really does go back to the mid-1980s when people began to conceptualize and to work out ways that they could engineer viruses to be able to transfer genes that they wanted. And originally, this was just a great tool for, you know, studying diseases and working with genes in the laboratory. But a number of, you know, investigators figured out that, wow, if we can do this with cells in the laboratory, this would be a way to, you know, do the same thing in patients and try to reverse, you know, serious diseases. And, you know, what really happened was very incremental progress. And we got, you know, really much better viruses beginning around the late 1990s, early aughts. And that's when, you know, really fast progress began to occur. In the last 10 years, you know, sort of exponentially better results in a variety of diseases compared to the kind of slow slogging with a lot of setbacks. But beginning about 15 years ago, really much more rapid progress began to occur because we understood the viruses much better.
There have been so many advances in getting viruses to introduce DNA into cells. You've talked about that. But I know that there's one big problem that's standing in your way right now. What is it?
Well, I think one big problem is how to take these advances that occur, you know, in very small scale clinical trials based on, you know, meticulous laboratory studies and figuring out a way to get it to patients and figuring out a way to pay for it. Because at least the way our healthcare system is structured right now, you know, paying a lot of money up front for something that may in the end up saving a lot of money is not something our healthcare financing structure is currently designed to deal with. So there's a lot of companies that are involved in this field, both small biotechs and large drug companies such as Novartis, that are, you know, trying to figure out approaches to figuring out how to get this to patients in a way that in the end will, you know, hopefully save money. That's one thing that keeps a lot of people up at night.
Dr. Cynthia Dunbar with the hematology branch at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Gene therapy is really a complete shift in thinking about how we treat disease.
That's Emily Mullen. She's associate editor for biomedicine at MIT Technology Review.
With gene therapy, the idea is that you can introduce new genetic material into a patient's cells and actually correct the genetic root of the disease and hopefully cure it. Then, of course, the question is, what price can you put on a cure?
With treatments ranging in price from $373,000 to $1 million, it's a major question in the emerging gene therapy field. What's a cure worth and who pays?
That's sort of a central question right now with these new gene therapies. As these new gene therapies come onto the market, is who's going to pay for them? Hopefully, patients will not be the ones footing the bill. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has said that it's going to work with Novartis, which is the maker of a gene therapy called Kymriah. This is the first gene therapy that was approved in the U.S. for a type of leukemia in children. And CMS has said that they're going to work with Novartis to make sure that patients who need this therapy have access to it. But the private insurance market has so far stayed mum on the issue of reimbursement. They have not really said whether they're going to cover these therapies and how much they are willing to reimburse.
And look, Emily, some of the problems with gene therapy might be the same problems with pharmaceutical companies making treatments for orphan diseases. All these diseases that we're talking about, immune problems, this form of lymphoma, these are relatively rare diseases. We're not talking about heart disease and high blood pressure. So doesn't this have a lot to do with the price?
It does. There's sort of a precedent already with rare and orphan diseases because so few patients have these diseases. The companies making these gene therapies and other treatments, more traditional treatments, they have more pricing power because there are so few patients who stand to benefit from them.
So, Emily, it's one thing to talk about a couple of rare diseases where gene therapy is available, but what about the future when really common diseases, the types of diseases that kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, are looking for gene therapy too? Is it going to be possible?
Well, that's a good question. So far, most of the gene therapies that are in the pipeline and the few gene therapies that are on the market right now are for rare diseases. But there are some researchers out there who are looking into gene therapies for more common diseases like Parkinson's, like heart failure. So I think the real test is going to be what happens when one of these gene therapies gets approved for a more common disease. How much is the price going to be when so many patients stand to benefit?
You know, Emily, one of the things that we've seen with the development of gene therapies is that a lot of the basic research is done in government institutions, NIH, places like that. Taxpayers pay for it. Then a treatment comes out and costs $750,000. Should taxpayers be concerned that companies make so much after the initial investment came from them?
So this certainly is a concern. And the other concern is that these therapies are only going to be offered at specialized hospitals and medical centers around the country, at least in the short term. Novartis actually said that they will only offer this gene therapy for cancer, Kymriah, at about 24 specialized hospitals and medical centers around the country. That means patients will need to stay in the hospital during this few weeks when the therapy is being prepared. That combined with travel costs getting to these specialized centers will likely add to the final price of the therapy. That's something patient advocates are also concerned about. The $475,000 price tag for this therapy is probably not going to be the bottom line cost of getting treated.
Emily Mullen, Associate Editor for Biomedicine at MIT Technology Review. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses, from laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Whether it's dental care or medical services, access is about a lot more than having insurance. It can also be about poverty or age or even geography. According to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's County Health Rankings in 2016, nearly one out of five rural counties has experienced worsening premature death rates over the past decade. Maggie Eluani is a government affairs and policy vice president at the National Rural Health Association, and she says rural America is experiencing a health crisis.
What I want to point out is really there is an onslaught of chronic problems that is really becoming overwhelming in rural America. We have an escalation of chronic disease, chronic poverty. You know, we declared a war on poverty 50 years ago. And those poorest counties in the country where that war on poverty was declared are still 50 years later, the poorest counties in the country. We have chronic workforce shortages, and now we have a rural hospital closure crisis.
So Maggie, it's been known for a long time that in many, many different health indicators, people just don't fare as well in rural areas as in the cities, and there are a lot of reasons behind that. Do you have evidence that lack of access to hospitals is driving a worsening trend lately?
Oh, there's absolutely many, many different studies that are showing the widening gap of worse health outcomes are growing in rural America. The Centers for Disease Control in January of this year did a leading study that showed the widening disparities gap between rural and urban America and the mortality rates escalating. You're actually living, you used to live longer if you lived in rural America. That is no longer the case.
So then that raises the question, Maggie, of what have been the policy choices that have closed so many of the rural hospitals and clinics that you represent? These things don't happen by themselves.
It's really been sort of a death by a thousand different cuts. So many different types of both Medicare and Medicaid cuts have really harmed these rural hospitals, where I said 41% are operating at a financial loss. We think one in three is really in financial jeopardy and at the risk of closing. What we see as really causing these problems are those cuts in Medicaid and Medicare, and unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act, which should have brought great promise to a lot of patients and providers out there, just the way it's been implemented is actually causing some harm in these rural areas. And I say that not because of the intent of the lots, the intent is fantastic, but so many states, so many rural states have not expanded Medicaid. And we know that rural America is disproportionately poor and disproportionately older, so reliant both more on Medicaid and Medicare. And unfortunately, even when we tried to get those private insurance options, those exchanges working in rural America, they just aren't working the way they were envisioned. You know, the goal was to be able to buy insurance just like you would an airline ticket, look online, see what plan made sense for you and your family, what you could afford. But unfortunately, there's no choice in rural America. We see these big insurance companies really pulling out of rural markets across the country. 70% of the counties that these big insurers have pulled out of have been in rural counties, leaving rural Americans with really no choice in care. They often purchase, when they can find some insurance plan, that really high deductible plan, thinking that may make sense for their family, that's all they can afford. But what we are seeing is that when they go into that rural hospital to get services, they really can't afford that deductible. So the hospital ends up subsidizing the care. And really the bad debt for rural hospitals has gone up by 50% since the Affordable Care Act has gone into effect, just both with Medicaid and Medicare.
Well, Maggie, you spend a lot of your time meeting with members of Congress and senators, I'm sure, and there are a lot of powerful lawmakers from these rural areas. It makes me wonder why over the years, I mean, the Affordable Care Act is only a few years old, but this problem's way older than that. Why have they not refused to allow their clinics and hospitals to deteriorate? Why haven't constituents pressed on these senators and lawmakers to not let it happen?
Well, you're right. It's incredibly frustrating. And this has been a problem that is building up for years. And but for the Affordable Care Act, I think we would see so many, many more closings. And instead of fixing the problems in the Affordable Care Act to really benefit those rural Americans and rural providers, all we've seen from Congress are really versions to repeal and replace that would worsen things significantly in rural America. You're right. It's very frustrating. That doesn't mean there's not a lot of well-intended members of Congress. And we do see some hopeful signs, and they do want to address some of these obstetric shortages. And there's some positive legislation out there. The House passed a bill that would better utilize the National Health Service Corps. That's a healthcare workforce program that allows medical individuals to be able to write off their student debt or get assistance with a scholarship if they practice in some rural and underserved areas. We'd love to see that program grown more and be able to target it to really get a better workforce in these rural communities, especially in obstetric care where it's so needed.
Maggie, I think about the leadership of Congress, and I'm not trying to single anybody out, but just to take the current leadership, I see John Cornyn of Texas, that's a very rural state. I see Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, that's a very rural state. I see Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, a very rural state. Lots of members that represent very rural areas, and I would have thought that they would have a direct stake in this.
Well, they certainly should have a direct stake in this. I think you make an important point. The birthplace of many of the most critically important rural healthcare programs have been in the Senate, specifically the Senate Finance Committee, which has always had such very strong leadership. As of late, however, Congress hasn't really been working through that normal committee process, especially when it comes to healthcare. Instead, a lot of the legislation has been drawn up by leadership staff instead of working its way through the committee, where we've got a lot of rural senators who have long offered important input and created important programs in rural America. We would love to go back to those days where that committee has a stronger presence with what legislation comes out of Congress. Unfortunately, it does seem like many of our concerns have gone on and have not been listened to by congressional leadership.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Todd.
Maggie Eliwani is a lobbyist and policy vice president at the National Rural Health Association.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses, from laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And if you ask a doctor about their biggest frustration, a lot of them will tell you it's when patients don't take their medicine as prescribed. Millions of Americans don't, and that can lead to expensive relapses and hospitalizations and billions in increased costs. But not all patients forget to take their drugs. For some patients, it's a conscious choice. In fact, a report from the Centers for Disease Control in 2015 found that to save money, nearly 8% of U.S. adults did not take their medication as prescribed. WNYC's Mary Harris recently sat down with Debbie Provost. Debbie was diagnosed with MS in the early 2000s.
Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Mary.
When did you know that you had multiple sclerosis?
I was watching a Montel Williams show, and he had already come out saying that he had multiple sclerosis. But this show was about the symptoms and some of the treatments and et cetera.
Welcome. You know, every single year it's important for me to devote at least 1 hour of this show to what ails me, and that's multiple sclerosis. All of you know I battle with it every single day.
And I realized that I had many of the symptoms that he was having.
And it's a daily battle that I've fought for now almost 10 years. For anyone living with a disease like MS and struggling every day, we all know we need to learn to live with our reality.
And he was talking about me.
What were the symptoms he was talking about that rang especially true to you?
Numbness in the legs and feet, coordination difficulties, some cognitive issues, also some trouble speaking. You know, your voice kind of isn't as strong as it used to be. You just are tired all the time. And I got a new job. It was a lot of typing, and they were having me learn everything about their business, and I was having trouble. I just wasn't getting it. My typing speed went all the way down to about, I'd say, 30 words a minute. And it was obvious to them and to me that I had a problem. They approached me, and I said, yeah, I think I've got something wrong with me. And they terminated me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's when I went to the doctor. That's when I knew I had to.
And what did you say to him?
I walked in the doctor's office and I said, I'm sure I've got multiple sclerosis. And he kind of looks at me. I've been going to the same doctor for years. And he says, are you serious? I said, yes, I'm serious. I said, I've already made an appointment with the neurologist. I just need to get your referral. So he did it. Within 3 weeks, I had the diagnosis.
You got this diagnosis from a neurologist. Did he immediately say, well, here's a drug regimen for you to get on?
She gave me two big folders with DVDs and all this stuff in it for two different drugs. She said, these are the drugs that I like to use, and read all about it, check it out, decide which one you want to do. And she wrote the prescription with several refills.
Now, in those two big folders full of information, was there anything in there about how much the drugs cost?
No. And I didn't know. I had good insurance. I had my ex-husband's insurance when I first got them. But then I started finding out that it's $7,000 and up.
When did you realize that?
Well, I didn't have insurance then. He had to cancel me because he couldn't cover me anymore under his work plan. And I didn't have Medi-Cal or Medicare yet. I hadn't been approved for Social Security. And I had to pay it. I didn't want to lose my legs. I paid it for almost 13, 14 months. I spent every dime of my life savings, almost $100,000 in those few months. Luckily, I was approved for Medicare. That was a blessing. But then there's a copay for that, and it still was like $1,300.
Did you ever think, I'll just stop taking these drugs and see what happens?
Yes, I did that.
What happened?
I did that. I stopped the Copaxone. Nothing happened right at first. And then it was about 2 months. I woke up and put my feet on the ground, and I couldn't feel them at all. I couldn't feel my legs. I touched my legs. I pinched my legs hard. I made a bruise in my legs.
So then you started going to the support group.
I heard about a support group in Manteca. They met at one of the pizza parlors there. So I thought, oh, that sounds kind of fun, you know. So I went, and it was really informative. I met some really interesting, nice people. One thing that happened, I was trying a pill at the time. This is much later, maybe 6-7 years ago. And I was trying this pill, and I was miserable with it. So I had stopped taking it and was back to the Avonex that I was taking previous to the pill. And they're all about the same price. All of them are $7,000, $7,500, $7,800, whatever. But there was this young man there who said that he was having success with that pill, but he couldn't afford it. So I told him that he could have whatever I had. And I know it was against the law. But when it comes to the point where you don't want to lose your legs, you don't want somebody to lose their eyesight, and this young man, from what I remember, he was having trouble with both. So I gave him my medicine that I had left over.
When you started meeting other people with MS, were you the only person worried about the cost of drugs?
Oh, no. That's a number one topic. We all talk about what insurance we have and, you know, how much are the co-pays. And the drug companies will help you maybe for a year now. But if you have Medicare or Medi-Cal available to you, they will not help you at all. So you're out of luck unless you can find an organization that is willing to pay for your co-pays.
Did you ever worry about what you were doing?
No. I knew I was doing the right thing in the long run. It might have been illegal, but I was still doing the right thing.
Debbie Provost, I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, Mary. I've enjoyed talking with you.
That's WNYC's Mary Harris speaking with Debbie Provost about her struggles to pay for medication. Thanks so much for listening to our Thanksgiving Day special about access to healthcare in America. We hope you have a wonderful and healthy Thanksgiving. Tomorrow, we'll bring you an hour on the opioid crisis in America. We'll look at how this problem started and what we can do to get it under control.
Most of the time when somebody dies from an overdose of opioids, it's during a relapse. So when somebody relapses, it doesn't mean we shut the door or we give up on them. It actually means the opposite. We open the door. We welcome them in.
We'll bring you voices from the front lines of America's opioid crisis. That's tomorrow. Catch us in between your Black Friday shopping, or you can always subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Todd Zwillick, wishing you a very happy Thanksgiving. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.